We will start. Let's see. So how many of you haven't been to one of my talks yet? Okay, so I was wondering, do I need to introduce myself again? But I guess I do. So I'm Elizabeth Marshall. I'm a family practice physician from Everett, Washington, married with two kids. I had an undergraduate major at Bowdoin College in comparative religion. I went to Dartmouth Medical School. And then as a midlife crisis, I've been going back and getting a master's in theology. And so as a result, I've been also doing medical ethics. So I continue to work as a family practice physician and am studying on the side. And so today's talk is really directly a result of the interface in my life between theology and medicine. And just some thoughts that I've put together, and actually I've presented this for physicians, just like the one I gave Tuesday night. I've never presented it for a non-physician group, so this is a real treat for me, and I've flipped it, and I'd love to know if it's helpful for you, and just because it is different for me. When I do this for physicians, what I'm trying to do is help them realize that their patients are spiritual beings, and that what people believe matters when it comes to their medical decision. And so we're going to kind of look at it differently. So I just wanted to start by asking you, when you're sick, how does your belief, or it might be lack of belief, it depends on who you are, but how does it come to play in your illness or when loved ones are sick? What, any thoughts on that?
You pray a lot.
It's the most common thing. Yeah. And in fact, for my years as a physician, when I get a new patient, I like to know if they have a spiritual belief or a faith community, and so I ask them. And because we know that people who do actually do better when they're sick, they tend to have a better outcome, or they cope with their illness better. So I'll say, do you attend any church or any synagogue or faith community? And if they say no, I then say, do you have any kind of spiritual practice? And if they say no, I say, if I told you you had cancer tomorrow, would you pray? And in all my years, I have had one person say no to that question. Everyone else said yes. But why do you pray? You want all the help you can get, okay?
For the other person or for yourself.
Yeah.
I was going to say, when my husband passed away many, many years ago, but when he was dying, the physician that we had was a man of prayer. And it meant so much to me to have him pray at the bedside of my husband.
And this may seem really dumb, but what about that was meaningful for you? Why?
Boy.
I'm your daughter.
Yeah.
For me, it meant more like even he wants God to help.
Yeah.
Like that felt real true. That's, we're all wanting God to be a part of it.
And you know, that's because I think that we recognize when we're up against illness that it's out of our control.
Yeah.
And we recognize and that there's a power greater than just the earthly world that might have some say in it.
Yeah.
And, okay.
That he wouldn't do things that I didn't think were right for my husband. It just gave me such confidence in him as a doctor.
He didn't think he was God.
Right.
No.
Yeah. Which is, that's a great thing. You're from Minnesota?
Originally.
Was that in Minnesota?
No, it was in South Dakota.
Oh. I just was wondering. That's probably more common in the Midwest.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to start. I want to start just by looking at a survey of belief in America and the trends. And then I want to talk about this kind of the spiritual tasks of being sick that we have. And then I want to look at kind of why I think as a society we've lost sight of those tasks, and give you some language even at the end on how do we talk with people about illness to help them talk about more than their next cancer treatment, which is what we frequently focus on in our conversation. So this is an interesting chart I found. Now, I'm from Washington, so we are down here, the third least church attendance in the United States, in Washington State. Whereas you can see, Mississippi has the highest rate of church attendance. So going to church in our nation really, really varies, and it varies by community. And this is a chart showing the same thing. So we're up in the green in Washington, where 30 to 34% of people say they attend church or synagogue. A lot of you from Minnesota, you're in the 40 to 44% up there. And then in the South, we see greater than 54%. But there is a great variation. New England, we see less than 25% up in the very corner, even less than Washington. However, in spite of what we think of church attendance, this is a great research study done of 35,000 Americans by the Pew Research Organization about 8 years ago, and 92% of Americans believe in God. 60% believe in a personal God. And if you go to the very bottom, which is the part that I really enjoy the most, this is, Washington State is this. People call themselves unaffiliated. 70% believe in God. And 20% of atheists believe in God, which means they're not atheists, but they just don't know. And then agnostics, 55% have a belief in God. So no matter who you're talking to or who you're with, they probably believe something. Even if they don't affiliate with a church, it's certainly true of my patients, and I live in what would be considered a highly unchurched area. This is another one I just love, belief in miracles. How many of you, when someone's sick, you hope for a miracle? I do. I mean, you know, we all hope for miracles. 79% of the population believes in miracles. And again, over half of people who have no church affiliation believe in miracles. And then if you go to the right, the belief in angels and demons. 68% believe in angels and demons. So what this means is I think a lot of us walk around with an unseen world that we don't even know many times is there. We make assumptions about each other, that person doesn't go to church, they might, you know, they don't believe anything. Which really isn't true. Belief in heaven and hell. This is a photograph I took in India. I was invited to go to a Sikh wedding in India. That's a photograph I took. But belief in heaven and hell, 74% of Americans, or of this sample, believe in heaven, and 60% or 59% believe in hell. And even down, if you look even down Buddhist, you know, 36% live in heaven, and Hindu. And so it's really, we never really know what people are thinking. Now, this shows the number of different, this says denominations down here. We tend to think of denominations as Christian, but this means everything. This means Muslims, Jews, every kind of thing. And if you notice, where I live in the Pacific Northwest is the most diverse, religiously diverse part of our country, with between 27 and 102 different. Now, I can tell you, in my community, we have the largest Sikh population outside of India in Vancouver, Canada. And so we live just south of them, and we have a Sikh temple, and my nurse was Sikh, and she invited me to her daughter's wedding, which... Actually, I put a picture of Jasneet there. Jasneet was born and raised in the United States. Went to the University of Washington, got married in India, found her husband online, got to meet him once. She liked him, she wanted to marry him. And this dress weighed 50 pounds. It was gorgeous. It was a sari. Anyway, so we have Sikhs. Microsoft, just in Bellevue, hires a lot of Hindus. So I frequently see Hindus. We have, in fact, one of my favorite stories is about a fellow who he wasn't my own patient. I was seeing him for another doctor, and he came in for a follow-up because he'd had a panic attack, and he thought he was dying, and he'd gone to the emergency room. And he goes, "Doc, I think I'm going to die." He was in his 20s. He was young. He looked like a gang member. He had heavy chains on, big rings, you know, kind of. And I was in a rush, and I was running late, and I was, like, not really invested in being a good doctor that day, I think. But anyway, he started talking about these feelings of his heart racing and everything, and I said, "You know, I think you've got an anxiety problem, and we should probably treat your anxiety." I did the whole, "Do you exercise? Do you drink coffee?" You know, I was doing all the good doctor behavioral things about anxiety. And I wanted to just, you know, sort of move on in my day, and as I was getting ready to leave, he started to cry. And I'm at least enough of a good human being to know that when my patient starts to cry, I need to sit down. So I sat down, and actually I was doing self-talk the whole time. I was going, "Okay, just stop your brain, Elizabeth, and be there for this person." So that was hard work I was doing. But anyway, he started crying, and then he told me the following story, which he had never told anyone in his life. He told me that he was born in Iran. He was Baha'i faith. His father was Baha'i and left when he was 2 years old because of persecution. And when he was, and he'd never seen his father since. When he was 17, he also fled Iran due to persecution. He saw people killed. He saw horrible things. He was in a refugee camp in Turkey, and he got addicted to opium, which really was because of his stress, his post-traumatic stress that he couldn't deal with. He came to the United States, continued to be addicted to narcotics. He married a woman who, interestingly, was a Catholic woman born and raised in Palestine, persecuted for her Catholic faith. And they had a baby who turned 2, like 2 months prior to him coming in to be seen that day. And he had decided when his baby turned 2 that he was going to die because his dad left when he was 2, which he never connected. I connected that for him. He also quit using opium because he wanted to try to live. So he was basically going through withdrawal. He had post-traumatic stress. He had suffered religious persecution. And he was leading this remarkable life, in my opinion, as somebody who, you know, kind of is aware of the religious diversity in our world. And he, at the end of this whole thing, I just listened to him, and I said, "You have a lot of grief." And I thought, he needs counseling, and he needs some medication. And he himself said, "You know, Doc, maybe we need to get some counseling about this stuff, huh?" And I was like, "Yep." And that was like the only time we ever saw this guy was that one encounter. But we have so much diversity. I have seen, and in the last, so we also have a population of Muslims who came in after the Kuwaiti War, one of 4 places in the United States the Muslims settled. And I took care of them. I started my practice in 92 when they came in. So I've taken care of them all the way through 9/11, which was a very amazing experience because in our community they were, I'd say, persecuted after 9/11 when they weren't before, but that all settled out. We just have this amazing, diverse religious community. And that is the United States in many ways. It's increasing. I recently saw a Coptic Christian from Egypt who was here because of persecution. I saw a Chaldean Christian from Iran. I mean, it's like fascinating. It's an amazing world out there. And it's increasingly coming to America. So in America, this is a Gallup poll that I just wanted to show you that this is all consistent. This is a recent Gallup poll. This one said 9 in 10 Americans believe in God or a universal spirit. 81% of Americans believe in heaven, and 7 out of 10 believe in the devil and hell. So that's a whole separate poll. The interesting thing about this one is that it says between 97 and 2004, those beliefs are going up. There's more people. angels going up from 75 to 2004. So this is increasing. That goes along with my experience. These are Buddhist prayer wheels in Dharamsala. So why is it increasing? Well, I think it's increasing because of postmodernism. I volunteer with teenagers, and the one thing I know about them is that religious experience is as real as anything you can study in a petri dish. There's no difference for them between the scientific truth and the truth of experience, and that is a postmodern phenomenon. So for them, if you say, I prayed and I felt better, or you say, I took Paxil and I felt better, those are both equally valid sources of feeling better. I think we're moving into this continuum where what is unseen is going to be as real as what is seen. And I think that's why we're seeing this change. This is my theory. But, you know, in science, ultimate truth was what you could prove. It was right or wrong. And in the postmodern world, as we know, many things are relative. And, the great question, what is truth, has been raised by the younger generation to a much greater degree. And I know many of my friends and peers see that as a negative thing. They always go, oh, there's relativism. But in a lot of ways, I see it leading us to maybe a new pursuit of truth in a new way. That God is true, you know. And miracles are true. I mean, you know, that we can contemplate the world maybe in a different way. So in my undergraduate religion major, religion ultimately is the search for the mysterium tremendum et fascinans, the mysterious, tremendous, and fascinating. And from way back when, it was really man's answer to what we can't control, which gets back to prayer when you're sick. The problem of pain, this big thing that we just can't control. I personally believe there is God, so I don't think we created religion. I think we know there's God, and we seek to find him. But we know that people in general obviously seek to find him. This is St. Peter's in Italy. So now just connecting this with when we're sick. This is another CNN poll. 94% of patients admitted to hospitals believe their spiritual health is as important as physical health. And 80% reported that physicians never or rarely discuss spiritual or religious issues with them. How many of you would say your doctor knows what you believe? A few, not many. A few. How many of you would like your doctor to know what you believe? That's another question. A few more. And if you raise your hand, tell me why. Why would you like your doctor to know that? Why would you like your doctor to know what you believe, if you would like your doctor to know that?
I think it helps them make better decisions. Yeah. For you, or, you know, be personal with their patients.
Yep.
They can pray with you.
They can pray with you.
When I told my physician I was going to come up here, she said, oh, that's a wonderful place. I was there when I was young.
That probably made you feel good.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think it would free the doctor to feel comfortable to say or be aware of things that they might not otherwise want to do, or to assume anything.
Yep.
Yeah, they would be able to share their faith.
They might be able to share their faith, yep. I think, again, that depends on your location. In the Pacific Northwest, most doctors wouldn't. But I think in the Midwest they might.
Okay, I live up in Ferndale, and my doctor's in Bellingham. And he knows that I was coming here. He's, I've got to get up there sometime. My wife and her family have gone up there. I just need to get up there sometime. So, you know, he doesn't know. I don't know what faith he is, but his awareness of this place makes me feel that he has a little knowledge of my faith.
Maybe, yeah, yeah. Well, they've actually done some studies on this stuff. This gets back to prayer, which we've already discussed, but basically everybody prays when they're sick, and the more sick they are, the more they pray. 82% of Americans believe prayer can cure illness. 73% believe praying for others can cure illness. 64% want their physicians to pray with them. Now, in our organization in Everett, we are not allowed to pray with our patients. They made an administrative rule. And that's 350 physicians or so.
Why? Yeah, why?
I do not know. It just, and they also made a rule that you can't have any religious decorations in your office. But you can still wear them. You can wear a cross or wear. But it's an interesting world we're living in when it comes to these things. Now, these lower three, I think, are really interesting because these, which we talked about a little bit on Monday, but these are about how we connect what we believe about God with our illness. So 80% of people say that health is a blessing. 30% say illness is a punishment from God. And 72%, this is from the Pew study, said it's related to a perceived sin. And I think it's worth looking at when you're sick what you believe about it. Because if you believe you're being punished, then your relationship to your illness is going to be really different than if you just say, God is good, this is my life, and I'm going to work on it. You know what I mean?
Can you explain the phrase perceived sin?
Yes, okay. This is how it was printed up. But I think that just implies that the authors aren't saying that the person sinned. The person is perceiving that what they did was a sin, and they are being punished for it.
But the respondent didn't regard sin as a perception.
No, they saw it as real.
Yeah.
Aren't there ways even within a secular worldview, we feel like it's our fault if we get sick in many ways?
Absolutely.
It doesn't have to be punishment from God, but you know, I smoked or I didn't exercise enough or I. People really struggle with that kind of guilt, even if they don't put it on God, don't they?
Absolutely, all the time. Absolutely. And yeah, there are things that cause you, you know, to get sick, right? But we're also all human. And people have been doing harmful things to themselves ever since the dawn of man. And so I'm not sure that that's a reason to hate ourselves.
But
I know what you're saying.
I wonder, as Christian, that situation is how to bring, forgiveness to people who don't see it within the same kind of theological worldview that I might have.
I think it's just by being there. Yeah. And also, though, if we can, as ourselves, understand what we believe about when we're sick. I think that's an important starting place. I mean, I had open-heart surgery and almost died twice, and I think for me, that forced me to really process, you know, did I do something wrong? I mean, that certainly was a thought I had when I was 34 and told I had to have open-heart surgery. You know, you kind of like go, oh my. Okay. That is Italy. Okay, this is back to what patients want. And this is really interesting. So, this is the line here is a normal old office visit with your doctor for a toenail or something. And a third of patients said they wanted their doctor to ask them about religious beliefs at a normal office visit. And this is, you're dying. And 70% said, yeah, I want my doctor to ask me. And then this is the pray with me. Half of people who were dying wanted their doctor to pray with them. I show that to doctors. Doctors are shocked, absolutely shocked. But it sort of gives them permission. So this is just sort of a summary of that. And this is another similar one that is asking, and I'll just flip to this, but would it strengthen your trust in your doctor if your doctor asked what you believe? And most people said yeah. Two-thirds said yes. It would strengthen my trust in my doctor if my doctor just asked, what do I believe? But I'm curious now. I'd love to see if you would it strengthen your trust in your doctor if they said, do you have any truth? Yeah, just raise your hand if that's true for you. Isn't that's so? See, this is what I'm trying to teach doctors. okay. Now, this is another study that basically the summary is you can see that how many doctors out of, basically 1% always asked their patients what they believed. And 43% rarely did, 8% never did.
What's SR?
That's spiritual religious. Yeah. But the bottom line is, we don't do it. But it doesn't mean you can't share it. You can still share it. Now, this is just boring, but really important. So I'll just summarize this to tell you there have been, since the 1970s, literally hundreds of studies looking at religion, spirituality, and the outcome of medical care. And I chose these because these are so interesting that after an elective surgery, meaning somebody didn't have to have it, they chose it, that if they had a religious practice or belief, they had a lower risk of death in the 6 months following that surgery than those who had no spiritual practice or belief. And that's not even a critical illness. The second one, a group of poor elderly folks who were forced to move because of their finances out of their home, they were twice as likely to survive in the two-year period if they had a religious commitment than the group that didn't. It's just, there's so many of these studies out there. Prayer, there's studies showing that prayer works. So the variable, this is really interesting to me, that the strength and comfort from religion, which really is, what is that about? And what do you think that's about? What is the strength and comfort you have from faith?
You're not alone.
You're not alone. That's a huge one. And it doesn't have to be all in your control. I think that's another one. You're leaning on something bigger. Yeah.
Question?
Yeah.
Are there any studies? Now, this talks about the religion of patients.
Yeah.
Are there any studies that correlate the religion of physicians with the course of their practice?
Brilliant idea. Maybe I should do that. Could never do it in Washington, however.
No.
I don't know. No, not that I've ever seen.
That's based on what you're saying from patients' perspectives, that would be an important study.
It would be really interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
Another interesting correlation would be whether it's just the ideas that people have, and it's a really private belief, or if they actually have members of the congregation coming to be with them.
So there is a great study that shows that participation in community improves your medical outcomes, and that doesn't even have to be a religious community.
Right.
And people who have a community like in North Everett, where W and I are, and grow old together in that community, they're healthier than people who move a lot and don't have a community. So you guys are all really blessed in that regard. Okay, so now I want to switch to just looking at some of the spiritual tasks of suffering. I would love it if you want to throw out. I know that's sort of a big question, but when you are suffering, besides prayer, what are maybe some of the benefits, if you want to say, the spiritual benefits or the purposes that you might see in suffering? Any thoughts about that? Because this gets into how we help each other. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it enables people to empathize better with other people who are suffering.
That's been true for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you learn empathy. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, when I went, I had a serious operation and didn't know what the outcome might be. When the doctor first mentioned what had to be done, I said, "Why me?"
Yeah.
You know, I think we all, that's the first thing. And he says, "Why not you? You're no different than anyone else." But then when I went in to have but he was nice about the way he said it.
Yeah.
And when I went in to have the surgery, the nurse says, "How come you're so calm? Your blood pressure wasn't up, you know, I was calm." And I says, "Well, I want to survive, but I'm not worried about the outcome. I have this feeling that God will be there."
I certainly had that going into open heart surgery with a 5-month-old baby. I prayed that God would watch over every detail of the anesthesiologist and the cardiac surgeon's work. And I just went. And it was like, what do you do, right? I'm no different than anyone else. But I certainly threw my life in God's hands in a big way, yeah. So I have made this list of how I think we can grow through suffering. One is prayer. Our prayer life certainly becomes active. It's good for our prayer life. One is presence for one another. Just realizing how important it is just to have somebody with you without doing anything. And this is where doctors can be much better, just being present. Again, companionship and intimacy. Illness is an opportunity when sometimes we tell our loved ones things we wouldn't say otherwise. Hope. And that hope is two kinds. The hope that you're going to get better, but there's the hope that in the book of Job is really just the hope that God is God and it's not about me, like you said. It's really not about me. This is life. And my hope is in God. In the book Tuesdays with Maury, that's a beautiful story in which what you really see is the community naming the illness as an opportunity to give dignity to this individual. Where the community comes around and supports and loves and confers dignity on that person. That's what hospice is. That's what we really need to do for each other. My priest, I'll get that in the next slide. The other thing is gratitude. So for 10 years, I couldn't hike. I couldn't jog. I couldn't carry my baby when she was 8 months old. And so I have this enormous gratitude for being out here. But then there's also the people who have gratitude while they're suffering. And one of my favorite patients who was a Lutheran, Beatrice Holyoke, who died at the age of 104. Baked cookies for my office when she was 100 years old. And when she was dying on hospice in her living room, I went to see her, and her final words to me were, "Thank you." And she is one of my heroes. You know, she just maintained that, right to the end. Amazing person. So just the reminding that life is a gift, it's not a right, and we aren't really different than each other, and we all suffer, and we might as well just go with it. You know, you just, but then the other thing, and this I learned, I'm Catholic, I learned this from my priest who had cancer in his 30s. He said something that sort of shocked me. He said, suffering is a commodity, meaning it's something we exchange in community. We buy and sell commodities. That's my daughter buying in a little market. But what he meant by that is we give our suffering to others and they give us back help, and we both benefit from that. It's meant to be exchanged in community. It's really not, you're not meant to suffer alone. And I think that's such a beautiful way to look at it. So, yeah.
Aren't there also people, and I guess so, at least to a certain extent, I include myself in them, when they're ill, do not want that. I mean, you want to crawl in the cave, pull the stone over the door, and when I'm ready to be human again, then I'll come out.
I think that's true, depending on what kind of illness you have and how long it lasts. Mm-hmm. I don't know, have you ever had a long illness with a prolonged...
Long meaning?
Months?
Oh, no. Not since I was a child. I had polio when I was a child.
It seems to me the more ill you are and the longer it lasts, the more you can't do it on your own, even though you think you want to.
I think it also has to do with the severity of the type of illness. If you're facing a life-threatening situation, you're going to come out. Very few people want to crawl into a hole and something like that. They've got things they want to say.
I had a friend who's a doctor who was estranged from her family, and she moved into our community. She really didn't know anybody. And she was in her 30s and was diagnosed with rectal cancer. And she was terrified. And she led a very insular life, and she was very rude and not very giving. And when she got this diagnosis, she thought, no one's going to take care of me. Nobody's going to take care of me. What's going to happen? And the community rallied around her took her to her radiation therapy appointments, made her food, you know, this, it was like this amazing experience for her, and it changed her life, and she actually then moved to Portland, Oregon, took up knitting, started teaching knitting, developed workshops. She's like, it changed her life because she learned that the community would be there for her when she was suffering. And I think that's, that we heal each other through being there for each other. And we forget that, you know? Grieving, this is another big one, and this is my talk tomorrow is really focusing on this, but a spiritual task of suffering is to learn how to grieve. Because you have to grieve your losses or they will come back and bite you. I definitely see this, but intense sorrow, heartache, anguish, angst, pain, and woe. I had a patient who came in one day. She said, I can't sleep, I can't eat, I can't, you know, I'm crying all the time. And I said, well, what's going on? She said, well, 2 months ago, my husband was using a tractor in our yard and it flipped over and killed him. And she said, can't you fix me? And I just looked at her, I educated her about grief. I said, you're grieving. She said, shouldn't it be over yet? I mean, like, grief is, we can go to McDonald's and get done grieving. I said, no. In fact, it usually lasts 2 years. You know, it'll get better. But so I just educated her. We meet as a society, we've just forgotten how to grieve. Mm-hmm. She felt so much better. She was like, oh, this is normal. It's okay now, you know. So the problem that I see is that in this age of modernism, we've separated the human aspects of suffering really from the scientific, and we focus on the scientific. And so we don't understand what we have to gain from suffering and how we can give to each other through suffering. This is a toolkit. This is what doctors have. We have lots of tools. And in fact, we have more and more tools. This is just a market analysis of the growth of medical devices. This is 2005, and that's 2014. Look at how much more junk we're going to be able to do to you in 2014 than we can do now. We can stick more stuff into your body. We can inject more drugs. We can, you know, I mean, it's amazing. The defibrillators, the pacemakers, the whole deal.
What happened between 2008 and 2009?
The economy.
Oh, this is in dollars.
Yeah. Yep. It's just remarkable how, and actually, the generation that's dying now, which is my parents' generation, is the first generation to die with all this technology, which is why I also do end-of-life stuff, because that's caused ethical problems. So, this is just a brief thing, but, you know, because I did this Tuesday night, but 80% of people are dying in an institution, not at home. 30% of Medicare dollars are spent in the last week of life. And patients feel abandoned by their physicians when they're dying. And physician satisfaction has gone down. And I think it's because we have too much technology. We've lost the element of the human part, where doctors need to remember that the person they are matters, not just the prescription they write. And that's just about physician satisfaction. But so, this is kind of my little summary about suffering. To be human is to suffer. To be fully human is to suffer with and for others in community in a meaningful way, and to seek to alleviate suffering wherever possible. Not that we don't want to alleviate it, but this is sacred ground. This is just a little thing that I talked about Tuesday night, but what is a good death? Because this all relates to how we die. We want to avoid suffering, usually pain. We want to be with family, have touch of others, be mentally aware, and not be a burden to others. That's kind of what people want when they die. I think dying is something that we can do much better in our society. So when you're sick, and you're just sick, maybe you have a sinus infection, you go to the doctor. Oops. Did that just flip into the next one? Yeah, okay, anyway, you go to the doctor, and you want them to fix it for you, right? And you really think they can, it's just an antibiotic. But when you are really dying, this part matters a lot more. And in fact, when you're dying, what we really see is all of these issues come into play. Faith, fear, hope, regrets, gratitude, forgiveness, reconciliation, confession. And medical technology is really just there to keep you comfortable. And that's why, as I mentioned Tuesday, we need time to die, and we can't die in the hospital if we're going to die with time to process, to do all of this work. And so really, we need to die on hospice. So I put this here because I hate this. Don't worry, be happy. And actually, when I lived in Milwaukee, Bobby McFerrin came and did a concert. This is Bobby McFerrin's song. My husband and I went, this is many years ago, and the audience started yelling out, "Don't worry, be happy." And he said, "I refuse to sing that song." He said, "I hate that song. I wish I'd never written it, even though it made him millions of dollars." Because he said, that's not what life is about. And he hated the way it was turning into this catchphrase for our society. And I've respected him ever since for saying that. But, you know, I have a friend who always says, it's all good. No matter what she, and then she'll go on and tell you all her woes. And you go, it really isn't all good. And it's really okay if you say, it's not really all good with me right now. Like, we don't talk about these things, or we're not supposed to. We don't have permission to. And we're seen as weak if we talk about suffering. And I think that's another societal thing that we need to change. And I think, and this is the question here, I think that medicine has made that worse. So do our methodologies that we have, all those tools, all those devices, do they ever become the conversation and they replace the conversation about the bigger and sacred questions? So when you have a friend who's sick, don't you talk a lot about, well, the doctor said this, and I'm going to do that, and there's this treatment, and da-da-da-da-da. And that's what the conversation is about. But there's so much more you can talk about when someone's sick. There's so much more there that we just neglect, I think. So I put some words up there because we don't know how to do it, and we don't do it very well because our society doesn't do it well. And these are great words, and I've used them with, I mean, I know I'm a doctor, so I obviously can, this is what I talk about with people, but you can do these with your friends. You just say, are you afraid of anything? That's a great question. Here's another great one, and this is from a medical ethicist. What does this illness mean for you? So when I had open heart surgery, it meant I couldn't carry my baby and I couldn't go hiking. When someone else has open heart surgery, it probably means something very different. So what they're grieving is very different than what you might grieve if you had the same illness. So what does it mean for you? I might not live for my daughter's wedding. Do you know? There's just a lot of different things an illness means depending on the person. And you can explore that in the context of a relationship. Sharing silence and sharing tears is just huge with people. Just remembering, when I woke up from my open heart surgery, it was awful because I was on a ventilator and I woke up about 50 times over 3 days, but I just remember that there was always someone in the room from my family. Never said a word, but they were just there. Another great question, what's important to you right now? Which might be, my lips are really dry, can you moisten them with chapstick? And what's important to you in the future? Well, I never finished my will. You know? These are really good questions to ask people. Is there anyone you'd like to see? And you don't have to be dying, too, you know? When you're sick, there's people you just want to see. When I'm sick, I want to see my best friend. How can you make that happen? Another good question is, where do you see yourself in the next couple of years or weeks? It's really common to be depressed when you're sick because you think you're never going to get better. And if someone asks you that and you say, well, I'm afraid I'm still going to be in this bed, you might be able to provide a lot of encouragement that, no, well, actually, I think you're getting better. I did this with my sister who had breast cancer and got very discouraged in the middle of a radiation treatment. And she called me and was crying. And I said, but Lee, I see this difference you've made over the last 3 weeks. And that just gave her courage, you know, because when you're in the middle of it, you can't see that. You're just like lost. And then finally, these are probably my favorite ones. The one I use a lot is, you are very courageous. Mm-hmm. It's because it takes courage to suffer, and just saying that to somebody can give them strength. You're not alone. As a doctor, I actually encourage doctors to take this attitude, which is impossible. I will be with you until the end, meaning that the doctor will make a good plan if the person is dying to help them die well. But just letting them know you're not going to abandon them to their illness. And how can I be your advocate? From your guys' position, people need advocates in the medical system. They really do. So advocating for people who are sick. And then I just put up there, in terms of dying, that remember, hearing is the last sense to go when someone's dying. So they can hear you. You might even want to assume they can hear you rather than assume that they can't. So I just wanted, just quietly, I wanted you to reflect on a time when you were suffering. And I'm guessing we all have that. And think about that time. And think about what was meaningful and helpful for you during that time. What helped you get through it? And then I want you to think about what you needed in that time that you didn't have. And if there's a way that you could remember and give that to someone else when they're suffering next time. And then I also want you to remember that time and think about what you're grateful for. And then, another little summary from me. Suffering is about intentional human presence for one another. The courage to be, not to do or to fix it. And gratitude. As human beings, this is level and sacred ground. Level ground, meaning we all suffer. We need each other and we need God. And then, for closing, I just have the scripture I love. Even to your old age and gray hairs, I am He. I am He who will sustain you. I have made you, and I will carry you. I will sustain you, and I will rescue you. Isaiah 46:4. Amen and amen. Any reflections or questions or, yeah?
One of my ahas came in my first labor. And they tell you, okay, so we're on the pain scale, you know? And never having been in pain, really, you don't know where you are because you don't have context. And so in first stages, you know, you go, oh, this is a 5. What? And by the time you're done and they have a baby, you knew that that was really a 1 or 2. Because we just don't know. And it's the same thing with suffering. There seems like there would be a real fruitful conversation between a physician and a patient around what pain and suffering have you experienced before and what worked for you around that and what didn't.
That's one of the questions that I'm teaching doctors to ask. That's a brilliant question.
Because you take your history and so much into your experiences,
and to have context around that is helpful, you know, I just, and it's really about the relationship you have with your physician. It's so crucial. I mean, there's got to be trust. That they know what you want, and that you know that they know what you want, and it helps guides that whole course of your disease or your illness.
It does.
It's crucial.
It's something I wish I'd said on Tuesday night, is you can make an appointment with your doctor just to talk about end of life. You can, and there is a billing code that we have for that. And so you can also make an appointment. It's really, sir, it's terrible, but we are measured. Productivity, da-da-da-da. I mean, we have all these pressures on us now. So it's actually harder to come in with your list of medical things and go, oh, and I want to talk to you about my living will, doctor. And it's like, whoa. Because that's an important conversation. But the other thing is you can call your doctor just to talk about how you're doing about your illness, or to, because there's something you want your doctor to know. You can make an appointment to do that. There are ways that we can bill so your insurance will cover it. And a lot of people feel like they can only go to their doctor with a problem. But if you want to say, I really want you to know this about me, doctor, don't ever do CPR, or, you know, this is important to me, you can make, you need to realize you're important enough that you can make that and take your doctor's time to do that. And there are ways we can bill for it, so, yeah, back there.
Hi, two things. I'm a hospital chaplain, and I've encountered situations where the doctor may not actually say there is no hope, but they'll say there's nothing more we can do. And in essence, saying there's no hope, or implying that. And what I've often been asked to do, or think it's important to do, is to talk to people about, okay, we may not have more treatments, the scientific part, but what do you hope for in the remaining time that you have?
Yeah.
And whether it be, I want to be with my family, I want to see so-and-so, I want to get home, whatever. That it, you know, just the end of medical treatment is not the end of hope. And I think hope is what sustains us as human beings. The second point is, you were talking about it's hard for people to talk about their pain or suffering. I also have found people, when they're grieving or suffering, have a hard time with some of the feelings they have towards God.
Yes.
The relationship towards God can change. And I've had people talk to me about how angry they are, but they can't share that with their pastor because they have this ongoing relationship, or they're not comfortable. So I would, you know, play the role of representing the church or God, but also giving them the freedom to express the human feelings that God understands and can certainly accept. But I think so many of us are growing up, you know, are taught it to, you know, be angry at God, or to be hopeless, or to be despairing is, you know, the worst thing ever. And when you go through real grieving or suffering, I mean, that's part of it.
That's why my topic tomorrow is lament. The importance of lamenting before God our grievances, yeah. Because I see people get sick, literally physically sick, who aren't able to grieve and lament.
In respect to grief, when my husband passed away, and I was a pastor's wife, and so I thought I needed to be so strong to show people that as a Christian, you know, oh, I'm just so, this is fine, you know, my husband's in heaven, everything's all right. So that first year, and people would come to me and say, you know, I just found out that your husband passed away 3 months ago, you walk around here as if nothing happened. The second year was very tough. You know, I kind of let things down. And so, like you said, it's going to come.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It does.
And for me, I just was trying so hard to be strong.
No. And that's a message our society puts out there.
Yeah.
And the Christian world puts that out there. That.
Yeah.
And I think it's because we just don't, and now I'm sorry, this may sound really obnoxious, but we don't understand God. that he suffered. Yeah. He suffers.
Well, I think this idea of we celebrate somebody's life, and that the term celebrate, you know, almost makes you think that you shouldn't be sad in any way.
Yeah.
Last year at this time, my husband had passed 3 months before. And I know there's a few people, the ones that understood what was going on, probably thought, oh, she's going on a vacation already. They didn't know, this what this was. It helped me to shed some tears and start to come back.
Yeah.
So it's, it was the best place I could be.
Yeah, that's true. Any other thoughts or questions or experiences you want to share? Yeah.
Well, one of the things when you had a listing of some of the good things that happened around pain and suffering.
Yeah.
And when you're a caregiver, it's hard to learn how to receive care.
Very hard, tough. It was terrible for me.
Yeah. And that was the gift in one of my really serious illnesses was to learn how to receive care.
Yeah.
Caregiving. And it was a wonderful gift. It helped me become a better caregiver in the future, you know.
Yeah, if you went to Laura's Enneagram thing yesterday, and if you're type one like me, learning to receive is huge. Yeah. It's hard for some people. And I think maybe for women more, because we're always giving. Yeah.
I think as a Christian community, we have to be careful how we use that term, God has blessed you with. And I know the traditional sense, I've heard this happen to me too. God has blessed me with wonderful children who are all happy and marvelous. Or God has blessed me with good health. And for those of us for whom that's not always true in our life, the opposite of blessing is curse. Now, I will say that, but that is the opposite. If you're going to look at a vocabulary. And we don't want to say, well, God has therefore, since he's blessed you with good health, he's cursed me with this. And that's where it comes back to saying, what did I do wrong?
Absolutely.
I think we have to be really sensitive to that with people who are struggling and suffering, not to use that kind of language. I think God blesses all of us, but it may not be in the way that we feel we want to bless him.
Absolutely. Such a good point. Yeah, there's especially in the Seattle area, there's definitely a sense that you can take control of your health if you exercise and eat right and do everything right. And that's huge in the Northwest, just huge. And I think people really get, I guess, would be anal about thinking they're going to live forever if they do this. And none of us are going to live forever. And you're right that, thinking of the scripture, he sends his sun to shine on the evil and the good, and his rain to fall on the, that it's, we all have blessings and we all have difficult times. Yeah.
The statement, kind of both for me would go along with that. Yeah, but for the grace of God, go I.
Yeah.
And that really bothers me a lot, because is this saying to somebody else, God, we didn't have God's grace.
Such another good point. I'm going to go write these things down.
I know my wife is here, right above me, I think. I'd love to have her comment on these points that you have. Her mother was 93 when she became very, very ill and was essentially, the doctors said, she is dying, she will not live. And Ruth and her brother were a constant presence with prayer, great companionship and intimacy. And Ruth, do you want to continue?
She's 98. She recovered.
Oh my!
We closed her apartment. I mean, we were told she would not live. And then she came to and said, "Yesterday was a really bad day." And little by little, but we never left her. I mean, we were there always. Not once she got sent to the nursing home, then we were there from 8 in the morning until 10 at night. And then she would, you know, we did leave her there alone. And it was an incredible experience to be with her. And we call these our bonus years. But it is all a gift. I mean, these bonus years are a gift, and she knows it, and she lives, excuse me, she lives as if these years are a gift to her. So she's been a real blessing to the family. But it was a lot of prayer, and it was a lot of being there and being her advocate. I mean, you talk about needing an advocate. Mm-hmm. When she was in the nursing home, the caretakers, you know, the paraprofessionals or whatever you call them, they didn't speak English, most of them. And so they couldn't understand, and she couldn't understand them. And yet, this is an experience that was really, you know, some of them were kind of cross with her because she was so ill and on so much oxygen and just, I mean, it was really awful. Anyway, they were very cross with her, and I decided, you know, there's something that's going in their lives that isn't good. And so I was always intentionally polite and kind, and it made a difference in how they treated her.
You are a very saintly woman.
I am not. Trust me, Paul would say not necessarily.
So
I'm not.
How long was that period of time that you and your brother excelled in?
It was 3.5 months. And then the funny part of the story is that after 3.5 months, Medicare didn't pay anymore, and her bill came, and it was over $7,000 a month. And she said, okay, I have to hurry up and die, or, I mean, she was still very, very weak. I either have to hurry up and die, or I've got to hurry up and get out. I've got to get out of this place. Now, how do I get out of this place? Oh. And I said, Mom, you've got to be able to dress yourself. You have to be able to walk with your walker, you know. And that was a turning point. And she, no, that was a turning point. It's all a gift. I mean, it isn't the same for everyone. But anyway, that's a fun story. You know. And she would talk about dying. And I would say, Mom, whether you live or whether you die, you are the Lord's. And each night I gave her a blessing as I left. And made the sign of the cross. You know, may the Lord bless you and keep you each time I left her. And so that's become a tradition when we travel now. She gets the blessing before I go. Mm-hmm. And that was as important for me as for her.
It's a great story.
Yeah.
And that's a wonderful story. One thing it says to me is that we need to start working on this with our children. To be comfortable saying, Lord bless you and keep you. Mm-hmm. You need to say the things, to use the words of faith in our daily life, mm-hmm. so that they're there if we need them. You can't just pull this out at the last moment. Mm-hmm. So this is a lifelong formation for God, mm-hmm. which in fact, if we pay attention to our worship, that's what we're getting every week.
Yeah.
We need to point out to one another, be articulate and specific, and worship well and often.
I think another thing we do forget is the importance of the opportunity to confess to one another. I think many times as a physician, I hear confessions. People come in and they that's what they need to do. But I think we don't do that for each other. Is there anything you need to talk about? Is there anything weighing on you, you know, that, because so many people carry secrets, and that first confess your sins one to another and pray for one another that you might be healed. I think that's a very important part of being really whole and healthy. And I see that with the teenagers I volunteer with, and I sort of make them do that from time to time. But, you know. Well, thank you, everybody.